From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the view from behind the camera with Academy Award-winning cinematographer Nestor Almendros. He shot Sophie's Choice, Kramer vs. Kramer, and Days of Heaven, among other films. Also today, we get a taste of New Orleans-style rhythm and blues with singer Irma Thomas. She had a string of hits in the 60s, now she's back recording again. Rock historian Ed Ward examines the career of Holland, Dozier & Holland, the songwriting and producing team responsible for some of Motown's biggest hits. And book critic John Leonard reviews Lost in Translation, A Life in a New Language. It's the memoir of Polish-born writer Eva Hoffman. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Nestor Almendros once made the observation that everything seems more interesting on film than in real life. Those of us who agree should thank cinematographers like Nestor Almendros for making those moving pictures so captivating. Almendros was called one of the greatest directors of photography by the late film director François Truffaut. They made 9 movies together, including The Wild Child and The Last Metro. In the United States, Almendros was the cinematographer for Kramer vs. Kramer, Sophie's Choice, and Places in the Heart. He won an Academy Award for his work on Days of Heaven. Nestor Almendros grew up in Spain. After the fascists won the Civil War, his father went into exile in Cuba and sent for the rest of the family in 1948. Almendros despised the Cuban film industry under Batista and left for France as a young adult, but he returned after the revolution and wrote film criticism and directed about 20 Cuban documentaries. Then he left Cuba again to work in France. He now lives in France, Barcelona, and New York. Almendros has directed a new documentary. It's called Nobody Listened. It's about human rights violations in Cuba under Castro. It features testimony from former political prisoners now living in exile. It's a follow-up to his 1984 documentary on a similar subject called Improper Conduct. Nestor Almendros, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
You're really known around the world as a cinematographer, yet you've decided to direct this new documentary, and I'd like to know why you wanted to make this documentary.
Well, first of all, I've directed before. I was a cinematographer. I did many documentaries in Cuba and in France. And this documentary, I made it because I think that what's happening in Cuba, oddly enough, is not well known. I mean, what's happening in Chile, for instance, in South Africa, which is as horrible as it is, at least they have the benefit of having the sympathy of most of the people. But the Cuban subject is ignored, and it's scandalous.
I think you're making the comparison to Stalin in your movie, that the left in America didn't want to recognize the atrocities under Stalin, and I think you're saying that the left in America doesn't want to open its eyes to what's happening in Cuba.
That is true, yes. The left in America is very slow in understanding, although there are people who have changed, like Susan Sontag and other people who remain on the left and have changed. I wouldn't say that all the left is favorable to Castro. They're usually, those who are favorable, they are people who are very misinformed, people who are misinformed, who prefer to dream.
Now, you started your film career in Cuba. You made a lot of state-sponsored documentaries about Cuba when you were there. And then you became disillusioned. What was responsible for that disillusionment?
Well, many little things, of course, and big things at the same time. I mean, you could see that the press was being controlled. Even our filmmaking was totally controlled by the government. We had to make constantly propaganda for the government, you know. But also the fire squads, the killings. I remember one night I was having dinner on the port of Havana with a group of friends, and I heard at the distance, bang, bang, bang. And I said, what is it? To someone, I said, don't you know? They're killing people in the Cabana Fortress, which is across the bay. And I was paralyzed. I couldn't eat anymore.
So that's part of the reason why you left the country.
Yes. I also knew that if I would stay there, I would end in prison.
You say in your autobiography, which is called, well, it's part autobiography, part about the movies you've made, it's called A Man with a Camera, and you say that in one of Castro's speeches, he condemned one of your movies.
No. He condemned someone else's movie, a movie I had defended, a documentary called PM, which was totally innocuous politically, but it was not produced by the government. And these people were just dismissed, and I was also dismissed as a film critic for having defended the movie.
In your new documentary, the shooting style is very straightforward. You have done some really gorgeous cinematography for narrative movies, and this is very, very straightforwardly done.
Yes, on purpose, yes. Uh-huh. I think there's no room...
Headshots, or talking heads, we'd call it.
Yeah, there's no room for aesthetics in a documentary. I think a good documentary should document and should left aside. I mean, it has to be beautiful, of course, and things have to be seen well, correctly. But there's no room for fireworks in photography or in music. You notice, for instance, that the film has no music in the background, underlining anything.
Sure, because you'd know every trick in the books for making the lighting really dramatic. So if someone's telling a dramatic story about their imprisonment, it would look as dramatic as it sounded, but you don't do any of that.
No, I try to be as normal and as close to the life as possible and see the face as well. I believe that the face, especially the eyes, are like a lie detector. And the more you see it, the better. I mean, the audience has to see that these people are not lying. They're saying an awful truth. And the more you see them, if you start doing arty lighting with half-lit faces, it might be very beautiful, but you don't see the eyes.
My guest is cinematographer Nestor Almendros. Now, as you pointed out, this is not the first film that you've directed, and in fact, you started your career as a film director in Cuba. Why did you switch over to cinematography? Because let's face it, it's directors that have the most glory as far as the behind-the-scenes people in movies.
Well, because when I arrived in France, exiled from Cuba, with no money, no help, I had to make a living. And I was a director, which was also a photographer. I mean, I was doing cinema verite, handheld camera. So I thought that if I could get people to use me on the professional, on the technical side, that would be easier to break into the business. And so it happened, especially when you are for free. You always find people that want you. And that's how I started the career. And then a career I really didn't think it was going to be my career, because I didn't intend to be a cinematographer. It just went skyrocketing, and then it even brought me to Hollywood.
You know, when I see a movie that I think is beautifully shot, I never really know who I should credit with it, whether it's the director or the cinematographer.
The director, always. The director. I mean, you cannot make good cinematography if you don't have a director behind letting you do it. So ultimately, it belongs to him. And the first question you said before that I forgot to tell you, the second part of it, is that doing cinematography for a man like Truffaut, or for Robert Benton, or Alan Pakula, or now Scorsese, as I'm going to, it's no sacrifice. It's really wonderful to work with a great genius, you know, and there's no regrets about it. It would be terrible if I would make bad movies, but I have made very few bad movies.
So that's really true. Now, you were telling me before that when you decide whether or not you're going to do a film, the first thing you want to know is who's the director.
Exactly. I am a film buff, and I practice La Politique des Auteurs of Cahiers du Cinéma. I believe that the worst film of Buñuel is better than the best film of a mediocre director.
Let's look at a couple of scenes from movies that you've directed and talk about what you did to get that look. Let's start with Days of Heaven. That's the movie that you won your Academy Award for. It's set in the American Midwest during the Depression. And there's a scene in which all the field workers are trying to pick, the locusts have invaded, and they're trying to pick the locusts off the wheat fields. And they're picking them off and then burning them. But for reasons I won't go into, the wheat field catches on fire, and there's a huge fire that engulfs this enormous wheat field. And you have all the characters silhouetted in basically black outline against these wheat fields. It's absolutely stunning. It's very hard, I'm sure, to film a fiery scene like that.
No, it isn't, in fact. Well, first of all, to begin with, we had to have a scene that gave opportunities to the cinematographer to shine. And here was a big fire. It wasn't the script. Terrence Malick had thought about it. He's a sort of a pyroman, do you say, or an arson man.
Pyromaniac?
He loves fire, you know. And also, he's a man from the country. He was from Oklahoma and Texas. He knows the fields. He worked in the harvester. So he knows that very well. Now, how you solve that, that's where I come. I believe that very often when you have a fire seen on the movie, they always have arc lights lighting on the dark side. And then by doing that, they destroyed the effect of the fire. I thought that it would be better not to do any lighting and just leave them in silhouette, as you noticed. And it makes like cave painting in a way. And there's a great beauty. Of course, we asked the people to be in profile because that's how you know a little bit who is who.
That's true. That's true.
Yeah, Richard Gere and Brooke Adams, they are in profile and silhouette, so you know who they are. There's a little trick, but we did two takes, one with light, for instance, in that scene, and one without.
With artificial light.
Yes, just to fill up, you know, so you would read on the faces. I thought that the one in silhouette would be better, and I was glad that Malik chose the one in silhouette.
Now, in the scene, there are sparks flying. It's very smoky. How do you keep a camera lens clean to observe
clean.
All of this?
It isn't clean. The cameras have to be cleaned afterwards. They get dirty. And then we got the smell of a smoke. The fire scene was shot during 10 days. It was, and the film is only 10 minutes perhaps, but it was 10 days. We burned a different field every day, and we were all smoking, and we had goggles to protect ourselves from the smoke. And the cameras, it's a miracle that nothing happened, but they could have been damaged, you know. There's always a little bit of risk in that kind of thing.
You said you burnt a different wheat field every day. How did you find fields to burn?
Well, that belonged to a religious group called the Utterites, but they're related to the Memnonites. They have enormous amounts of wheat. They have enormous amounts of field because it's collective ownership. And they just sold it for the price of the harvest. They were very happy. They didn't have to harvest and they got the money from it.
How do you know for sure that a take is going to be good? For instance, in this scene in Days of Heaven where there's fire raging out of control, you'd better know that take is a good take. You're not going to want to, after the fires are all put out, you're not going to want to do this again.
Well, that's that's the great excitement of films, that you don't know precisely. So when you see the rushes later on a dark room, you're always surprised. It's usually, as we said at the beginning, better than in life. Things always look better in movies. And sometimes you're disappointed, but most of the times it's better.
Cinematographer Nestor Almendros is my guest. Now let's compare what you did on Days of Heaven with another movie that you shot. You shot Kramer versus Kramer. Now, Days of Heaven has obvious opportunities for incredible photography because you're talking about landscape shots, you're talking about period photography, it's made in the Depression. Kramer versus Kramer is a naturalistic movie set in apartment buildings and office buildings, and it's a very, you know,
it's
realistic type of movie.
It's the most difficult thing to do.
Now, I think it would
fact,
be the other way
it
around.
Is.
That,
no,
that a period
no.
movie
The other
would
one
be
is
a
piece
difficult.
Of cake. You know, making a film with landscapes and waterfalls or... they're the films that win Oscars always, and
right.
frankly, non-deserved very often. The moment you have a film with thousands of extras, costumes, especially if it's a costume movie in India or in South America or in a period movie like ours, which people were not dressed like today, and you have mountains and fields and clouds, but that's there by Mother Nature. Yet people think, oh, what wonderful photography, and it's the easiest thing of the world. But doing an apartment like in Kramer, every day, you know, everyday banality, get beauty out of it. That's the toughest thing.
Yeah, so what are the challenges shooting Kramer versus Kramer in an apartment building and an office building?
Well, that it has, although it's shot in studio, the apartment of Kramer was built in studio. It's not a real one. It was copied after a real one.
Mm-hmm.
And we had some window scenes that were shot in the real one, but most of the shoot was done there. So to make people feel that they are there, that it's true, that's not a set, that's not fake, you know, that feeling of reality, also of a three-dimensional feeling, especially for night scenes, which are the most difficult to do, that there is a depth, that there's a lamp here and a dark area, and then another, like it happens in life, there's a dark area here and a lighter one there. And then also that the different rooms of an apartment, people are aware of it, that people feel that they could walk into that apartment, that's not abstract, that it's true, that could be theirs. And that takes some kind of, you know, engineering. You have to.
Let's look at the actors that you had to shoot in Kramer versus Kramer.
Well, that also, it's the most important film. This kind of movie has an advantage over the other kind, which we said, is that the actors come out wonderfully. Because they have no competition.
Well, one of the leading actresses in it is Meryl Streep, who you also shot in Sophie's Choice.
She was practically discovered in Kramer. I mean, that's what it made out of her a star.
Compare how you lit her for Sophie's Choice with how you lit her in Kramer versus Kramer, and why. The different ways you shot her
in
both
different,
those films.
Yeah, it's very different. Sophie's Choice is a very stylized movie. Here, it's a period movie, too. It doesn't happen today. It happens after the war.
Right.
So here you have the chance to stylize things because people have forgot how things were. That's the advantage of doing films which are period. Also, you have all those flashbacks in Poland, which allowed us to do also some stylish photography. But in Sophie's, we sort of got ourselves inspired from Technicolor movies of the 50s, you know. The lighting was a little more harsh, bigger shadows, more expressionistic, whereas in Kramer it was more naturalistic.
Mm. When you're arranging the light so that you'll have exactly the kind of effect you want to achieve, then the character's going to move. I mean, is that a problem, that if you want a certain dramatic lighting effect, that they might move the wrong way or move right out of
that
effect?
Well, that's a compromise. In fact, the good way should be let the actors do their number first and then do the lighting.
Mm-hmm.
You don't do the lighting and then you ask them to move into the lights.
So you watch them rehearse first and then figure out how to light
it. First, the director decides where they should do, where they should go. And then I'll come and I'll do some lighting. And sometimes we will tell them, why instead of walking there, don't you walk to the other side so you'll get a better light? And some actors like Meryl Streep, Jack Nicholson, they have a good sense of light. They really know where the light is. Sometimes you don't even have to tell them. They have tropism, you know. They know where the light is.
Now look at someone like Dustin Hoffman. He's got a very big nose, a kind of unusual face. Does he require a certain kind of lighting?
Well, he is like a chameleon.
Mm-hmm.
You say that?
Chameleon, yeah.
Chameleon, yeah. He can be anything. In Kramer, he's very handsome.
Mm-hmm.
And so is in the first film he made, The Graduate.
Right.
And if he wants to be ugly, then he can be Rizzo in that film.
Midnight Cowboy.
He can be anything he wants, like Meryl Streep, too. Meryl looks very ugly in Ironweed, and she wanted to be. You know, I thought that we made him look quite good in Kramer. He looks like, I mean, he's not Gary Cooper, but he's an acceptable man, I think.
What do you look at in a face when deciding how you're going to light it?
Well, I belong to the Greek or Roman tradition, so I do have an idea of beauty, which, of course, has to do with that inherited a culture that we have. I mean, if a person has a huge nose, then we'll try to not to show that because the Greeks had that sense of proportion. The mouth could not be that big. The eye, the nose and the eye should be of a good size and the ears also. So I look at that first without any consideration for the light. I try to see the person as you see an animal, not really forgetting that you are a man, you know. And then once you see these defects that the person might have, you try to conceal them with the lighting or with the framing or with the position of the person in front of the camera. You know, if a person has an ugly profile, you'll try not to have this person in profile very often. And if it has a beautiful profile, then it's the opposite, you know.
My guest is Nestor Almendros, and he's one of the most respected cinematographers in the world. His movies include Kramer versus Kramer, Sophie's Choice, The Last Metro, Days of Heaven. We're going to talk more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Cinematographer Nestor Almendros is my guest. And by the way, his latest movie is actually a documentary that he directed, and it's about human rights violations in Cuba.
By the way, I co-directed it.
Co-directed. Okay, co-directed thank you for pointing
that
out.
Jorge Yula.
A Cuban emigre.
A Cuban emigre. Really born in Cuba, not like me.
Let's talk about black and white versus color. You have shot some movies in black and white, including My Night at Maud's.
Yes.
Of course, you started, unlike film history, which started in black and white and went to color, you started in color and did a few films in black and white.
Yeah.
Now, Wim Wenders, when I recently interviewed him, said that black and white is the most difficult thing
to shoot
and to develop. Do you agree with him?
Yes, it is very difficult because it is difficult and it is easy. It has some easy aspects and some difficult. The easy one, I'll start by that, is that it's very elegant.
Yes.
You cannot be of bad taste in black and white. Everything looks correct. You see, the worst movie of the 40s, which was in black and white, and there's always a basic elegance. I mean, things, they never have that gaudy aspect that bad movies have today, you know. Then the other problem that black and white has is that because of the lack of information of black and white, the lighting has to be like a painting. You have to be silhouetting things, singling out objects and things you want to see, because you see much less in black and white.
Because it's all shades of gray. There's
because
no colors to stand out.
There's very little to tell. People have to see what's happening with only black and white, whereas the other one, there's an infinite amount of colors which tell you different things. So you have to color, black and white has to be much more refined, you know, and much more work if you really want to do something that people can recognize.
Since the labs don't have to process that anymore, do they know what they're doing?
That is one of the problems, too. That's why I don't like to do black and white today, because the results are always very poor. And those who have this obstination, like Woody Allen, for instance, of doing black and white, they bump into a wall. I mean, it's just, what can you do? It's such an unusual thing. Labs don't know how to handle it anymore. And also cinematographers, us, we don't know how to do it anymore. It's an art perdu, lost art.
You know, you mentioned earlier that when you started working in movies, that you were the director and the cinematographer. You were directing the documentaries and you were shooting them too. Things have gotten very, very specialized, perhaps more so in America than in other countries.
Well, but on the other hand, that director-cinematographer figure, it still exists. There are still many directors of documentary. I believe the documentary should be done by the cinematographer. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, how can a director tell a cinematographer, do that and do this? You know, there are always instant reactions that it's impossible to develop. So, no, there's still many people who do documentary and who are like an home orchestra. No?
Do you think things are too specialized? For instance, in America, you point out in your autobiography that the cinematographer can't run the camera.
Well, this is the legitimate Hollywood cinema unionized.
Mm-hmm.
But there is also in America, parallel to that, you know, non-union movies and movies made, thank God, you know, in the other way, in avant-garde and with little crews and lots of little money. That film we made, Nobody Listened, was made that way. It's a non-union movie with very little money and an incredibly small crew.
You've made nine movies with late François Truffaut, and after Cuba went to France, and this was at the tail end of the French New Wave.
Yes, in fact, I always have that image. Is that it's like if I got the last car of a train that was already speeding up.
How did that change you, seeing the French New Wave movies and then working with the French directors when you got there?
Well, I didn't work right away. I was, for 4 years, I was starving in Paris. I went back into teaching. It wasn't easy. And I didn't even have money to go to the movies. I skipped many of the movies of this early period because I couldn't afford it.
Mm-hmm.
It was a miracle, really, that I got to work with these people. And as I say, I got the last car, you know. Some people identify me with the new wave. In fact, I got into the middle of it, you know. I was lucky enough that they still got it.
But once you did start working as a cinematographer, how did what you were doing change you? I mean, what was different than what you had? Obviously, it was feature films, it was fiction film.
What I had done before?
The technique.
Not really, nothing. In fact, if what I brought into movies, if I have brought into movies, is my experience in documentary, because that's what I had done in Cuba. I did documentary with no lights, with available light. So when I did My Night in Maud and La Collectionneuse and The Wild Child, I use that technique. It's like they're like documentaries in a way.
Do you feel that many viewers think of the cinematographer too much as a technical person, part of the technical crew, as opposed to part of the artistic vision behind
yes,
the movie?
Yes, that's one of the mistakes. I think the schools, film schools, they always have those exams to accept people. And they always insisting in mathematics and chemistry and things like that, which really you use very little. If you are a cinematographer, unless you manufacture film and you go to Kodak to work in laboratories, but otherwise you don't really need that. And I think by doing that, they eliminate the people who are artistically inclined. And I think it's an art. I think it's an artistic activity. I don't know if it's an art, but it's an artistic activity, as being a cinematographer.
Your next movie is going to be with Martin Scorsese. I forget the title of.
New York Stories. It's composed of three stories, each one directed by a different director, an omnibus movie, as they say. One is directed by Woody Allen, the other one by Francis Ford Coppola, and the last one is Martin Scorsese, which is the one I'm going to do.
Have you worked with him before?
I did a little TV commercial in Italy for for Giorgio Armani, and I admire him enormously. I think he's one of the greatest directors in America and in the world, so I consider myself very privileged that he called me.
Now, you choose your movies according to who's directing them. What specifically are you looking forward to about working with Scorsese?
Well, I praise style very much. You know, there are some good directors which I don't admire because they don't have a style. And Scorsese has a style. It's that nervousness, that New York electricity. And I think he has a style. He has a signature. I like to work with people who have a style, who have a universe of themselves.
Now, your style is somewhat international in that.
Oh, I don't have a style. No, I mean, I try not to have a style.
Uh-huh.
The problem is I don't succeed, but I try not to have a style. I try to adapt myself to every movie.
And you've done that in many different countries. Is it really different working from one? Let me ask you, let me put it this way. I have friends who tell me that their lives were changed by going to Italy because the light is so beautiful. Is it true that the light is different in different countries, and does that affect your work?
Well, the light is the same everywhere, but it bounces differently against the architecture of Italy and the uh-huh. vegetation. That's what they mean. Of course, some countries have more clouds than others, but, I mean, sunlight is the same. No, but the look of the countries, of course, it does make a difference, but the world is shrinking, you know, I don't find any problem about moving from one country to another. On the contrary, it stimulates me. I like this change. I like to do a big movie and then make a little one, and make a fiction film and then make a documentary. I like the alternate.
We only have a couple of seconds left, but what do you think are the movies that cinematography should be measured against, the greatest, the best shot movies that you've seen?
Well, I think that the films which have to do with common things, that's where you can measure a cinematographer. As I said before, films with landscapes, they're the ones that pay the most, but they're not how you should measure a cinematographer. See a normal day, everyday film, and that's it.
Nestor Almendros was the cinematographer on Kramer vs. Kramer and Days of Heaven. He directed a documentary on human rights violations in Cuba titled Nobody Listened. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, we meet Barbara Katz Rothman, author of Recreating Motherhood, a feminist perspective on surrogate mothers, sperm donors, and the new reproductive technologies. She wonders if we're starting to see babies as commodities and pregnant women as unskilled workers on an assembly line. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Singer Irma Thomas made her first recording in 1958, and now more than 30 years later, she's still belting out her own brand of New Orleans R&B. Coming up, we meet Irma Thomas. Also, rock and roll historian Ed Ward reveals three reasons Motown sounded the way it did: Holland, Dozier, and Holland. Eva Hoffman was born in post-World War II Poland and came to this continent when she was only 13. Along the way, she developed a love of books and a yearning for the intellectual's life. Our book critic John Leonard reviews Hoffman's new memoir, Lost in Translation, A Life in a New Language. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Brian Naylor. It was announced today that President-elect Bush will lead the U.S. delegation attending the funeral of Japanese Emperor Hirohito. A Bush spokesman said the President-elect and Mrs. Bush will attend the funeral in Tokyo on February 24th. It is Bush's first announced trip abroad as president. The Reagan administration today recommended reducing the insurance on deposits in the nation's banks and savings and loans as part of the effort to reform the nation's troubled S&L industry. NPR's John Idstey reports.
The recommendation came in President Reagan's final economic report. The report suggested reducing the level of insurance would cause depositors to more closely monitor the financial health of the institutions holding their money. As part of such a move, banks and savings institutions would have to disclose more information about their financial condition, according to Beryl Sprinkle, chairman of President Reagan's Council of Economic Advisers. But the idea was not well received by congressmen, including Democrat Charles Schumer of New York, a member of the House Banking Committee.
Congress will stand four square behind the $100,000 agreement. I can't conceivably see of us reducing that amount. There are other ways and much better ways to skin the cat.
Several other members of the House Banking Committee agreed with Schumer, and so did one member of the Reagan administration, Treasury Secretary Nicholas Brady. He issued a statement saying that reducing deposit insurance would not be one of the recommendations he would make. I'm John Idstey in Washington.
One of the nation's largest banks today agreed to pay $14 million in back wages to women and minorities employed from 1973 to 1988. But the Harris Trust and Savings Bank of Chicago refused to concede it discriminated against them. The bank said it was agreeing to settle the charges originally filed by the Labor Department in 1977 to avoid, quote, more legal and statistical wrangling. The FBI today arrested a former Navy technician on charges of trying to sell anti-submarine warfare secrets to the Soviet Union. Officials say Greg Kunkel sold the documents as revenge because the Navy discharged the former chief petty officer for indecent exposure. If he is convicted, Kunkel faces a sentence of up to life in prison. The Soviet Union today raised the possibility that it might not complete its troop withdrawal from Afghanistan in time to meet a February 15th deadline set in Geneva last year. The warning was widely viewed as an effort to step up pressure on Muslim rebels fighting the Kremlin-backed government in Kabul. NPR's Ann Cooper reports.
The warning came from Deputy Foreign Minister Yuli Vorontsov, who's been holding talks with the rebels in Pakistan. At a news conference today, Vorontsov refused to give a timetable for withdrawing the remaining Soviet troops stationed in Afghanistan. Vorontsov said there's a serious danger that events in Afghanistan will prevent completion of the withdrawal before the deadline. Vorontsov implied that the Soviets will wait for further word from the rebels, who announced yesterday that they were ending talks until after the withdrawal is completed. Vorontsov has been trying to negotiate formation of a coalition government that would rule when the Soviets are gone. The Kremlin wants assurances that the coalition will include the party of Afghan President Najibullah, but the rebels have balked at any proposal that shares power with the Soviet-backed president. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
Eastern Airlines officials hinted today they will speed up planned sales of assets because of an impasse in negotiations between the carrier and its largest union. The chairman of the National Mediation Board called off the talks earlier this week. The machinists, representing more than one-fourth of Eastern's employees, are asking for raises that would total $50 million a year. The airline wants $150 million in concessions. Stock prices were lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Industrial Average dropped more than 6 points. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. In the 1960s, the Motown record label became synonymous with soul music. Some of the producers and songwriters who started there went on to create their own successful labels. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward has been listening to the music of one such team, Holland, Dozier, and Holland.
Part of the Motown mythology, the three girls everybody believed in but nobody could get a hit with. But then, along came two brothers, Brian and Eddie Holland, and their friend Lamont Dozier, a songwriting and producing team like nobody'd ever seen before, and shazam, the Supremes started having hit after hit. It was no miracle, though. The three guys had been around Motown a while, and Eddie Holland had even had one of the company's first hits, Jamie.
Listen, my friends, while I tell you about a girl that's so divine. I love her for the joy she's brought me, for she's mine, all mine. Oh, Jamie,
Jamie.
Talking about Jamie,
Jamie.
Talking about Jamie,
Jamie.
That's my love.
Between them, they knew everything there was to know about songwriting, arranging, and producing. And between them, they came up with a significant number of Motown's best-selling records between 1964 and 1968. But in 1968, they also became Motown's first rebels, the first members of the family to decide that Berry Gordy, Motown's president, wasn't giving them a fair shake. They demanded more for their efforts, and when they didn't get it, they quit. It looked like a smart move. They had talent, they knew where to get performers, and they quickly set up two record labels of their own, Invictus and Hot Wax. Motown's lawyers did everything they could to keep them from being able to release any records, but by 1970, they started having hits. The chairman of the board's Give Me Just a Little More Time was filled with classic Holland, Dozier, and Holland production tricks, and it was a big hit here and in England. It established the Invictus label, which had a funny gray drawing of Rodin's Thinker as a black man on it, and it also established the chairman of the board. Over at Hot Wax, their other stable of stars, they applied their touch to a girl group, something they knew a lot about, and started rolling in the number one hits. Want Ads was number one for what seemed like forever in 1971, but my favorite song by this trio, The Honeycomb, was this reworking of the basic Louie Louie riff. And although The Honeycomb was produced by Holland Dozier Holland's young protege, Ron Dunbar, you can hear that he had their tricks down cold. They also did well with solo female singers. On Invictus, Freda Payne had a pop hit with Band of Gold, but her biggest success on the soul charts was an anti-war song the Top 40 radio refused to play, Bring the Boys Home. And on Hot Wax, they took Laura Lee, a refugee from Chess Records' blues stable, and revamped her with a women's lib image. Still, I think she did a better job with plain old shouting, and so did record buyers. Whoa. There were others. Flaming Ember with their hit Westbound No. 9, 100 Proof Aged in Soul, Glass House, even George Clinton's Parliament recorded for Invictus and Hot Wax. But in the end, Motown won. Holland, Dozier, and Holland didn't make disco records, so their empire faded away. And in this country, they couldn't exploit themselves as nostalgia, either. Thanks to my friends at Demon Records in London, these great records live on overseas. But if you love Motown, you might want to seek them out.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He says he doesn't know where the Holland brothers are today, but Lamont Dozier is a soul singer who has become a star in Europe, though he continues to live in the United States. This is Fresh Air. During the 1960s, New Orleans soul singer Irma Thomas had a string of regional hits. Songs like Ruler of My Heart, It's Raining, and Wish Someone Would Care, which also made it to the national top 20. The 70s were hard times for soul singers, and Thomas was no exception, but there's been a renewed interest in her classic soul singing. Rounder Records has released two new records in the last 2 years. From her latest album, The Way I Feel, here's Irma Thomas singing Sit Down and Cry.
Most people who have written songs for me know that I like songs that tell good stories. I have some kind of a storyline to it. And so oftentimes when music is presented to me, unless it has a story, it doesn't appeal to me at all.
Is it hard for you to find songs now that you want to sing, that
suit you? Yes, indeed. Yes. It's like pulling teeth, because most people who can write and have written hits have always sent them to people who've had a track record of hits.
One of the songs that was written for you by Alan Toussaint is called It's Raining.
Right.
That's a really nice record.
Thank you.
Have you listened back to that recently, and have you thought much about how your singing has changed over the years?
Oh, my voice is quite different from then. My voice seems to be deeper than it used to be. I have a little bit better range than I used to have. Of course, I'm an older now, and things do change as you get older.
It's raining so hard, look like it's gonna rain all night, and this is the time I'd love to be holding you tight, but I guess I'll have to accept the fact that you're not here.
Let's talk about how you started to sing. Did you ever sing in church before you started to record?
Yeah, every Southern black child has sung in church at one time or another if he ever attended church. I can't ever remember not being able to sing, and it's just been a part of me. I just thought everybody did it.
Do you remember the first time you actually got paid for it?
Yeah. I was about, I was 17. This was before the record.
And what happened?
I got $2.
Where were you singing?
in Mississippi at a place that rained out, and we earned $2 a piece, and we had to give it back to put gas in the car.
So you were 17 when you started to actually perform professionally?
Right.
One of your early records was the song Time Is On My Side, which the Rolling Stones later recorded it.
Uh-huh.
How did you get to record it? What was the story behind you recording it?
I was asked to do it when my contract was bought along with the Minute label. I was asked to do Time Is On My Side as a part of an album session. And I did it. I thought it was a good song at the time.
Were you surprised when the Rolling Stones recorded it later?
I didn't like the fact that they, you know, they had done it, and I knew my version was better. It sounded better. It was better produced. And here's a group of guys who I didn't feel sung all that great, had a million seller. But looking back on it retrospectively, it was because of the times and what was going on at that time. English groups were migrating into the United States, and the United States public was eating it up. And if you were from England and didn't care how bad you sung or how good you sung, you were a hit. And I just got caught up in the middle of all of that.
And I think it was 1970, you left New Orleans for Los Angeles?
Right.
What made you want to leave the city? It's a city that you were, you know, really associated with musically.
Well, when your livelihood depends on the nightclub bookings that you have and Mother Nature comes along and tears it all down, what do you do?
What do you mean by Mother Nature tore it all down?
A hurricane named Camille came along and devastated the Mississippi coast area where 95% of my bookings were.
Oh, so all the clubs were demolished?
Yeah, the whole coast was demolished. I mean, they had to rebuild the entire coast, just about.
So you left for Los Angeles.
Right.
How did that turn out professionally for you?
It didn't. I wound up getting a day job at one of the major stores there and working to support my family. And then finally I moved to Oakland, where I was able to do some gigs and work in a profession that I enjoyed doing.
You know, in the early 70s, in a way, it was kind of difficult times for soul music. I think everybody... a lot of people who had been listening to soul music gave it up for psychedelic music, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So was it hard for you to find your audiences back then?
No, I just kept doing what I knew how to do. I didn't adventure into trying to do psychedelic music as such because it didn't appeal to me. And I just continued singing the kinds of songs that I enjoyed doing that I knew how to do well and stuck with it. I didn't get a hell of a lot of gigs because of it, but by the same token, those gigs that I did get were appreciated by the audiences, so I just stuck with that.
What made you move back to New Orleans?
Work. I was coming back to New Orleans often and spending more time back in New Orleans than I was in the Bay Area where I was living at the time. And then I met my third husband there, and I got married, and he said, you either live in New Orleans or you go back to California, so I moved to New Orleans.
Do you think of yourself as having a New Orleans sound?
No, I think of myself as having an Irma Thomas sound. It would be the same no matter where I was.
Let me ask you about another song on the record.
Okay.
The song I'll Take Care of You. Why did you want to do that one? It's a great recording of it.
Uh-huh. I've always liked that song since Bobby Bland put it out in the early 60s. I've always liked that song.
I know you've been hurt by someone else. I can tell by the way you carry yourself, but if you let me, here's what I'll do. I'll take care of you. I've loved and lost the same as you, so you see I know just what you've been through. So if you let me
fans not realize that you're still recording new records?
They know I'm doing them because what I do, I try to bring the records to the gigs with me and offer them to them on the job. But most of the record shops, when they buy the record, they stick it in the oldies section. I mean, it's not an old record, it's new records, but they stick them in the oldies section. Or they'll put them in oldie females or something, you know, some category where nobody would think it's there unless they knew where to go look. And I think it's unfair to me as an artist because I am recording new songs, and they should display me with the rest of the top 40 people and give me a fighting chance.
Why do you think they do that? Have you talked to any of the
record
stores?
I have no idea, but I'm going to find out when I get back home. I'm going to ask them, why do you put my records over in the oldies section? And they'll have to come up with an answer because I'm definitely going to ask.
I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Sure, I enjoyed it.
Irma Thomas's latest album on Rounder Records is called The Way I Feel. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is joining us from Washington, D.C. with a look ahead to All Things Considered. Robert, what are you following?
Well, we're following some congressional hearings with a lot of controversy over the Federal Home Loan Bank Board's plan to help out a lot of ailing savings and loans by putting up guarantees and getting private entrepreneurs to take over those banks. We'll also be hearing about a very controversial article in today's Washington Post, which suggests that the weapons officer in the F-14 that fired on the Libyan jets was premature in doing so. The Pentagon went to great lengths to rebut that article today. We'll hear both from the Pentagon and from the man who wrote the story. And a story about triplets who met when they were all 19 and now are very close friends and business partners.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Many people have written about the immigrant experience, but book critic John Leonard says Eva Hoffman has something new to offer in her memoir, Lost in Translation.
On the surface, Eva Hoffman's story is not so unusual. She was born in Poland in 1945. "I come from the war," she says. "It is my true origin." She grew up in Krakow, a gifted pianist, a reader to whom books were as real as the people next door. At age 13, pushed by anti-Semitism, she emigrated to Canada and, quote, "a whole new geography of emotions." In high school in Vancouver, she missed the texture and plenitude of her life in Krakow, a net of meaning. At Rice University in Houston, Texas, she missed the frame of Polish culture, the weight of European history. In graduate school at Harvard, out of immigrant rage and self-consciousness, a critical, quote, "triangulation of the old Eva and the new on each passing moment, a sloughing off of, quote, "excess darkness," and a deconstructing of her raw North American experience, she discovered a vocation for literature. She decided to become a New York intellectual, and that is what at last she is. So much so, she adds slyly, that she's even seeing a psychiatrist. Deeper down, Lost in Translation is something more wonderful. As a childhood memoir, it has the colors and nuance of Nabokov's Speak Memory. As an account of a young mind wandering into great books, it recalls Sartre's words. As a ghost story of the immigrant experience, a counterpoint of discarded and invented selves, it belongs on a high shelf with Other People's Houses by Laurie Siegel and The Woman Warrior by Maxine Hong Kingston. As an anthropology of Eastern European emigre life, American academe, and the Upper West Side of Manhattan, it's every bit as deep and wicked as anything by Cynthia Ozick. And yet, for all these ironies and all this resonance, Lost in Translation is also, quote, "a talking cure for a particular woman. She is a Jew, an immigrant, half Pole, half American. She lacks Nabokov's aristocratic freedom and privilege. She feels herself sometimes a mosaic, sometimes a hybrid, and sometimes an oxymoron. She would like to relish our spontaneity, but she's wary of, quote, "the space sickness of transcendence, the terrors of multiplicity, the unbearable lightness of American being. Why, she wonders, do we talk so much about our mothers and so little about, say, the Russians? How, she asks, does one stop reading the exterior signs of a foreign tribe and step into the inwardness? She is building a second language, quote, from the roof down. Obsessed with opening oral doors, she will write her way out of exile, into the very viscera of our meanings. I want, she says, to accumulate a thickness and weight of words so that they yield the specific gravity of things. I want to recreate, from the discrete particles of words, that wholeness of a childhood language that had no words. When she can trust English enough to let it speak her childhood self, the molten force she felt herself made of in Krakow, under a chestnut tree, when time, like a river, pulsed through her blood, her translation of these tales of Hoffman will be completed. And so it has been. This brilliant polyphonic book is itself an act of faith, a Bach fugue, a kind of heroism.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, is a columnist for New York Newsday, and is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Lost in Translation by Eva Hoffman. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz shares some new evidence suggesting that one of the greatest classical composers wrote music we've been unaware of until now. And critic Ken Tucker tells us what's new in home videos. So I hope you can join us. And we'd love to hear from you. Drop us a line. Our address is Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, 150 North 6th Street, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. That's Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, 150 North 6th Street, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Today's show is produced by Mark Vogelzang, Phyllis Myers, Amy Salad, and Naomi Person. Production assistance from Lisa Bruton and Deborah Beagle. Research assistance from Tim Jacoby. Our engineer is Orji Vablaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.